Welcome back, everybody, to the Case Notes from the Field Social Work Podcast. My name is Ernesto Bejarano from Social Work Mentor, and I want to thank you for choosing to listen to this episode. You're going to be happy that you did. It's very interesting, and it covers some stuff that you may not be familiar with, so we're going to get into that in just a second. But before we do, I'm not quite sure which platform you're using to listen to this at this point right now, but if you could either like or follow or subscribe or whatever it is, that would be super helpful to me because it helps other people find the podcast so that they can also learn from a lot of our colleagues in the field that I'm interviewing, that I have interviewed, and that I'll be interviewing in the future. So if you could do that favor for me, I would appreciate it. And without any further ado, let's get into the interview. Brittany Williams is the person that we talked to this week, and she talked about her experience in social work entrepreneurship, which is quite interesting. She talked about how she got there, which is even more interesting to me. And to me, the most interesting part, the most interesting part of this interview is when she talks about hip-hop therapy. It's something that not a lot of people, I don't think, are familiar with, but more and more people are trying to integrate into their practice. And so let's learn a lot more here about Brittany Williams and what she's doing. I hope you enjoy it. I found it very interesting, and I hope you do too. So let's get into it. All right. Welcome, everybody, to the Case Notes from the Field Social Work Podcast. As it said, my name is Ernesto Bejarano, and I'm really excited today for today's show, especially because we were having a little bit of technical difficulty, so I was afraid we might have to reschedule, but it looks like we're on track and all good. So we have our guest today. This is a person who I kind of, similar to our last episode, someone that I've kind of just gotten back and forth a little bit online, specifically mostly on TikTok. And so we might get into a little bit of conversation just about that whole thing and on TikTok. But this is the first time that I'm meeting, quote unquote, in person, our guest. So as you know, if you've been watching this show is primarily about the social work journeys of our colleagues and kind of the learnings, the trials, the tribulations that they've gone through. And so we're going to have a lot to learn from our guest today, with specifically social work entrepreneurship, as well as hip hop therapy, two very interesting topics. So that's enough of me talking. Why don't we go ahead and hear from our guest, and I'll let you introduce yourself.
Yeah, what's up? Well, thank you for having me. My name is Brittany Williams. I'm a licensed clinical social worker. And I own a private practice, a group private practice with my best friend, Carlos. And I'm also an adjunct professor at a community college. I teach social work courses. And on top of that, I'm a big advocate of something called hip hop therapy. And I'm just grateful to be here today.
All right, cool. Thank you. It's nice to meet you. And I'm sure our viewers, whether they're seeing this live or after the fact, are going to be excited about some of the topics that you heard about, because I know that you talked about it. I know I'm excited. But before we get to those specifically, I kind of wanted to just get to know you a little bit more and maybe hear a little bit about your background, kind of if whatever you're comfortable sharing, obviously, but where you come from, your kind of childhood journey, maybe through high school and college, and then to the professional world. So I know there's probably a lot to cover there, but yeah. I'll leave it open to you. And I may go ahead.
No, I was gonna say it's a great question to kind of lead into where I'm at today and why I do what I do. So it's a good question, but it is a lot.
Well, I may jump in here and there just with questions or to try to keep an eye on time as well. So pardon the interruptions ahead of time, but why don't we go ahead and get started with that?
Yeah. So I'm a third generation Mexican American. My parents are originally from East Los Angeles. My mom's from Monterey Park. I grew up in the San Gabriel Valley. And I think one of the interesting things to know about me from my childhood is that my grandma was the first one to teach me social work. I didn't know it back then, but I do know now, like, a lot of the values and a lot of the her interactions with people is what guided me into this work. And so In elementary school, I did not do well in school. I experienced a lot of difficulty academically. My principals, teachers told my parents that I would never make it. And so for a long time, I just didn't think that that school was for me. And it wasn't until high school that my best friend Carlos introduced me to underground hip hop. And I began rapping and just like lunchroom ciphers. And it was in that setting that I felt validated, and I felt important, and I felt a part of something bigger than myself. And so that kind of is what saved me, really, is hip hop. And then after high school, I ended up having my daughter at 19. So I was a young mom. I was a single mom for several years. And I'm a product of the social welfare system. You know, I'm a product of the reason why I am in the position that I am today is because I got Cal grants and because I got, Medi-Cal and certain benefits that I received because I was a single mom. So I received that help. And I had a professor in a community college that asked me a simple question, and he just asked me, like, where do you want to transfer to? And I was like, I don't really want to transfer anywhere. I just want to get it. If I could get an associate's degree, that's a win. And he was like, well, if you could go to any college, where would you go? Like, let's just say you're, you know, giving yourself a permission to dream, where would you want to go? And I said, I want to go to USC because my uncle had went there, and being my family's from LA, so USC is kind of like the heart of the city, right? Mm-hmm. And so he's like, you can do it. Like, let's create a plan. So he created a plan with me, connected me with resources, you know. And it's interesting because a teacher and an educator at a young age kind of destroyed my confidence in the academic world. But a teacher in a college setting also restored my confidence in the academic world. And he connected me with so much. So I ended up applying. It wasn't easy. I had to ace several classes for USC to even consider me. Let's just say I had a lot of fun in high school, so my grades weren't good, right?
There's so much, before I forget all this stuff, there's so much there that as we knew it would happen all the material there to ask questions about. But I think there's two things that really resonate for me. One is when you say that your grandmother was your kind of the one who taught you social work. And I think that's a theme that maybe is similar to a lot of people that come from communities sometimes, and this might not be your experience, but it kind of is mine, communities that don't have a lot of resources, communities that don't have a lot of opportunity for things. And so the resources, the support network is really the community and the individuals in the community. And so oftentimes you see your family, you know, helping out the neighbor or whoever they happen to see in the community, just because we all knew that there was us helping each other or no one really, unless we were forced into some help through the system. So that's one thing. And then the other thing I find interesting too, is that the experience that you had with your teachers, and one discouraging kind of in high school, and then one really being a shining light for you to get you to where you are now. That's interesting that you say that, because the past couple of guests that we've had have actually had one of them mentioned very specifically how in high school they were really, I was going to say discouraged, but just flat out put down and insulted right, for being accepted to UC Berkeley. And then more recently, the guest talked about how there was a particular college professor that kind of brought them out and made them who they are in a lot of ways. So those themes are, you know, on one hand, it's unfortunate that yourself and our other guests and who knows how many other people are experiencing these negative things in school. But at the same time, it's inspiring to know that there are those educationally, at least at the higher levels, that can, you know, empower a person like yourself to do great things. So I think that's really interesting.
And it's really a blessing to be in the position as a community college professor now, to be in the position where I could instill that hope and confidence into my students. Like, I see that as my way of being of service, right? To giving back. I always tell teachers this all the time, man, like you are in a position to save lives. Like I know, you know, social workers, you know, we do that as well, but think about how much time teachers spend with their students. You know what I mean? So, so I think that that's, my professor in community college really, I think it was after I read Our Prison's Obsolete by Angela Davis. And I was like, yo, this is, I got my bachelor's in sociology. So I was really, and he was a sociology professor. So I really wanted. Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So I applied and look, like just to have the courage to apply was a big thing for me. Right. Mm-hmm. I didn't know if I was going to get in, but I was just kind of the biggest step for me was to literally on that one day, just turning in that application, putting it in the mail. it was crazy for me. And so,
unknown, like to a lot of people, that's just a complete unknown thing. And you're just kind of jumping in and hoping for the best in some ways.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know if I was going to get in, but I ended up getting in. And I remember that day I got that letter and I felt like I made it. I made it for my family, not for myself, but for my family. I felt like I continued on like the legacy of being a Trojan in my family, taking that, you know, after my uncle or whatnot. So it was a special day because I didn't think that I'd ever make it to that level. Right. Uh-huh. So I went to USC. I got my bachelor's in sociology. And then after that I got married and then my husband's prior Navy. So he's a veteran now, but he was active duty back then and we got stationed in Oahu. So I got my MSW from the University of Hawaii at Manoa.
Okay. Yeah. So that's kind of your condensed story from kind of birth through college. Yep. And then I know, and we'll get into where you are now for sure, but before you got to your current role and what you're doing now, right. Let's just go with this. What did you do after school? How did you get into the professional world once you finished up with the academic side of things?
After my MSW?
Yeah. Or even if you want to, if there was something after your BSW that was significant.
No, there wasn't. I was down to find like any kind of job. That was like in 2010, 11. So, you know, there was nothing available.
Uh-huh. So I guess it's after the MSW then.
Yeah. So after my MSW program, I just needed to find a job. Like, to be honest, I was in this place of like, I don't want to say survival, but almost. My husband had just got out the military, right? So when you're in the military, you have a lot provided to you. You have healthcare, you have stable income. There was a lot that was provided to us and we didn't have any of that, right? So my husband and I kind of switched roles where like he went to school and took and had the kids and I was like working. So I was trying to, it took me a while to find a job. I ended up getting a job at a nonprofit and I worked with, I stood there from when it was my first job out of grad school and then my last job before I went into entrepreneurship. So I started there and I worked in the TBS program. So it's a county contract and we basically go into like group homes and even residential care of facilities and provide behavioral counseling and services to youth whose placement was at risk due to the behavior. Mm-hmm. So these were at promise youth that were displaying pretty severe behavior, suicidal behavior, aggression, right? Significant like histories of trauma, attachment issues, all that. So I worked in that setting for a while. And during that time, I was working towards getting my hours, getting clinical supervision. Mm-hmm. And then I transitioned to another program within that nonprofit. And it was working with students in school districts that had IEPs. Mm-hmm. So they were struggling behaviorally in school, right? Mm-hmm.
So was it, how big was the nonprofit that you worked for? Was it a large organization or a kind of a smaller grassroots, or what was that experience?
Yeah, in comparison to other nonprofits out here in San Diego, I would say it was pretty small. Mm-hmm. There was only like two locations, right? Two sites. And so it was
a county program, or it was contracted through the county?
It was contracted through the county.
Okay. Yeah. So I imagine you work closely with child welfare and I don't know what you call it down. DCFS, is that what it is in San Diego?
Yeah. And to be honest, we worked more so with the county liaisons. Okay. So it was more so that. And so that was a county contract. But once I went into the other program working with school districts, that was a school district contract. So I was outside of the county. So I was more so working alongside like the school, the school system, and understanding that process. And I did in-home therapy. So I would literally go from home to home and travel in my car. And I really enjoyed it. I liked I was never boring. Like I really liked going from house to house and being in different environments and understanding people within their environment, right? That's social work, person, and environment theory. Right. So I really got a good taste of that. And then in 2018, I started teaching on the side. And so I really felt like that was something I was passionate about.
And how did that come about, the teaching thing? How'd you go from what you were doing and get into that?
I met my best friend Carlos at a coffee shop. So Carlos, you probably also see him on my TikToks. We co-own our practice together, but he's a social worker and owns a coffee shop in City Heights. And I went to that coffee shop and he threw a lot of like mental health awareness types of events, suicide awareness and whatnot. I went to one and him and I, my husband, like we just vibed and we started doing work together. So what ended up happening is he was teaching two classes at that college, but he also teaches at San Diego State. And he had a scheduling issue with one class he couldn't teach. He's like, "Hey, would you be interested in teaching?" And I was like, "I don't know. Like, that's kind of scary, right?" he's like, "And like," and it's an ongoing joke between him and I. He makes fun, you know, I'm very clinical. That was just my training. Mm-hmm. And he's like, "Wait, you're clinical. You could teach this tomorrow." And I was like, "Well," so, I took the risk and I was scared, but I did it and I ended up loving it. And so, I stood at my nonprofit job I left last September. So I stood there for like close to seven years.
So you were doing the nonprofit and teaching at the same time.
And once I got licensed, I did a lot of side hustles. Mm-hmm. I did consultation work for inpatient programs. I worked at another nonprofit, another private practice on the side. Mm-hmm. So the really cool thing about getting your license is you can generate multiple streams of income and not even work more than 40 hours a week. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah. So, I've seen on several posts, I think, of yours where you mention about kind of like your family and they had, you know, they had hustles and they were always doing their thing. And so how do you think that has impacted you and your ability to kind of move in the therapeutic social work kind of circles and transfer those foundational entrepreneurial skills into, you know, kind of maybe like the next level or what you're doing with it?
Yeah. So my dad owns a plumbing company. And basically once he opened that, I grew up pretty poor, right? But once he started opening his business, my parents started making money my mom helps my dad run the business. And now my little brother, who's 4 years younger than me, is now taking over the business. And so seeing that kind of modeled for me growing up, my dad didn't go to college. My dad is definitely a hard worker though. My mom is too. And they taught me a lot of they taught me a lot of like skills that may not be viewed as valuable in the academic world, but really are. And I think that we're moving towards that, right? Like, we're no longer seeing intelligence as IQ scores, but we're now seeing emotional intelligence be valued. Yeah. And you look at multiple intelligence theory, all that. So my dad and my uncles, they had the gift of gab. They knew multiple people. They were able to build relationships in the community and build businesses, and in turn create opportunity for their family. And my dad and my uncles really taught me the value of ownership, right? Like, my son is one, he has a guaranteed job when he gets older, if he were wanting to do that, right? And make good money. My little brother probably makes more money than me, right? Plumbers make good money, but, you know, construction, my uncle did, you know, tile and construction. And I just, there was a point in my career where I just really had to ask myself, like, I have a master's degree, I have a clinical license. What am I afraid of? Like, they took the leap. What's my excuse? Mm-hmm. And so they really not only taught me the skills, but taught me like the highs and lows of entrepreneurship, that you got to take risks, that you have to confront the fear, distinguish the fear, and walk towards the healthy fear that's causing you to grow into a better person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and probably I would imagine you saw a lot of resiliency too, because when you take risk, you know, there's ups and there's downs, as you mentioned. And so in order to be successful in business and entrepreneurship, there's a lot of people that just fall off once those hard times hit, because they haven't had those foundational skills to be resilient, to keep going past those challenges. So as you were doing your side hustles or transitioning more kind of formally to your actual business, were there any setbacks or specific particular things that you experienced that maybe could have been those potential things that had you fall off, but you found a way to get through it?
I mean, I definitely think that, a lot of it was internal, right? Mm-hmm.
Was it like that foundational stuff that you talked about, just from seeing your parents and your uncles and everyone doing that? And that just like builds this thing inside of you as part of who you are. So it's not necessarily like a called out skill set, but it's just part of your kind of like your DNA.
Yeah, I mean, like, a lot of it was believing in myself with no security, right? That's entrepreneurship. Mm. That's the spirit of entrepreneurship, is you have that relentless confidence in yourself with no security. Like, there's highs and lows to it all, right? Mm-hmm. But I think one of the biggest challenges, which shout out to TikTok, because it really has helped me learn this piece, is marketing. I didn't know how to go about it, hire somebody, not hire somebody. And then also, you know, Carlos and I as a group practice, we're a little bit different in the sense of we're truly ourselves in our practice. You know, and you can see that on our TikTok, like, we're ourselves. We listen to the music that we listen to. We talk openly about our personal experiences. And I think that that's what drew the population to us, that resonated with us, because in therapy, you want to get to know a little bit about who your therapist is, their lived experience and what's important to them and who they are as people. And you and I know that traditionally you're not supposed to talk about that, right? Like, it's this, do you self-disclose? Do you not self-disclose? And so figuring out how to market yourself in a way that is like good for business, but also true to who you are, was a roadblock that I hit. And my parents couldn't teach me that because they don't know much about social media. and then Carlos doesn't believe in social media. I had to talk to that. But what happened is I had a video that, I don't know if it went viral, I guess. I don't know. It kind of did. It hit like a grip of views. And I'm like, it hit me in my kitchen one day when I was making my kids lunch. It hit me. I'm like, we're the brand. like just being ourselves.
I think I know which one you're talking about. Because I noticed when I saw that video, was it one of like the first ones when you guys were just kind of dancing?
And, yeah.
Yeah. And I saw that and I saw that it was kind of going viral or whatever. And then the good thing that I think maybe this is what you're talking about is you seem to have learned from that. You then kind of doubled down and you tweaked it and made them better. And you've continued to develop that. But but that sounds like I saw that from the outside. I saw that you picked that up and you ran with that. And it seems to have been effective.
Yeah. And I mean, from that day on.
I can't wait to hear what's about to come next. But before we get to that, a quick break just to remind you, as I said in the beginning of the podcast, if you can like, subscribe, follow, whatever it is on the platform that you're using to this podcast, that would help immensely for others to be able to find it and listen to it and benefit from it. And if you want to find out anything else about Social Work Mentor or get free social work resources, go to solo.to/socialworkmentor. That's solo.to/socialworkmentor. You could just go to the links on this podcast, click on them, and you'll find me there. So enough of that. Let's get back and see what Brittany is about to say next. Here we go.
That's how we're generating traffic, right? People are contacting us for therapy and whatnot. And it's a little bit different for me. I kind of grew up in like the Instagram, Facebook, MySpace generation. Yeah. Right? And my daughter is 15 and she introduced me to TikTok. And I swear, like, this is so embarrassing to admit, but I used to think that TikTok was like a dating app or like, you know, I didn't know anything about it, right? And so my 15-year-old was like, Mom, there are therapists on TikTok. I'm like, no, they're not. Like, come on. She's like, there's doctors on TikTok, psychiatrists. And so she's the one that actually taught me how to even make a TikTok, right? And then from there, I just kind of individualized it. And, you know, Carlos and I meet every week on a Sunday and we push out content.
Yeah, I think that's huge too, what you just said about your daughter. I also have a 15-year-old and she was on it when it was still Musical.ly, and she's like she's always ahead. I've learned now to pay attention to her because she's kind of got her finger in what the next thing is. And so she also introduced me to TikTok, but I tried it for a second, but I just couldn't get it. I didn't get it. So like, I just left it. And then I came back a few months later and that's when I saw you and a few other people. And I was like, oh, okay. So then I still don't by no means have, you know, understood it or dedicated myself to it as much as I should probably, but I mean, the impact that you can have. Oh, the other thing is I was going to say is that you have to be humble. It sounds like a lot of people would listen to their daughter and say whatever, you know, not pay attention or minimize them, but you were able to be humble about what your daughter was telling you and keep an open mind. And so that's paid dividends.
You gotta listen to the youth. You have to listen to the youth. They know the next move.
Yeah. And I was gonna say one other thing too about I forgot, it'll come back to me. But so I'm glad you touched on I have my notes here that I'm looking at, but you touched on the kind of the transition or the not necessarily transition, but this is what I was going to say. The idea of sharing a little bit about yourself or being real, as you mentioned, you know, we're always trained and taught, you know, to have those boundaries and don't share any of that. But since day one of my social work career, and I've been doing it for almost basically 25 years now, I kind of by default at first, because I didn't really know what I was doing yet, and I would just disclose a little. I still had boundaries, but I wasn't as tight as people seem to want me to be, and I always found that just allowed the youth to connect with me more and build rapport. And so when I saw what you're doing with hip hop therapy that we'll get into, that, you know, I hadn't necessarily heard of the concept of hip hop therapy specifically, but just the thought of using contextual, situations, well, not situations, but information or what people are actually real about and into, to use that as a teaching tool and as a tool to engage with people. That's really the thing that really got me looking at your stuff. And so if you can maybe, yeah, I guess at this point, talk to the concept of hip hop therapy, because I don't know if everyone is aware of it, but it's awesome.
Yeah, people add therapy to everything, right? But hip hop therapy is actually like a real framework that was developed by Dr. Edgar Tyson in 1996. It's a strengths-based, culturally relevant framework, and hip hop therapy is kind of a remix of traditional therapeutic concepts such as DBT, CBT, psychoanalysis. So it's a mix of that with hip hop culture. And if you look at what hip hop culture is, hip hop culture is comprised of DJing, emceeing, breakdancing, graffiti art, and knowledge of self, along with some other sub elements, but it's kind of merging the two, right? So for example, we know that affirmations and meditation and mindfulness is a big practice in helping individuals regulate stress or deal with really intense emotions. Well, the way that I've actually incorporated that into my practice with individuals is by utilizing music and having them meditate on one part of the song, or having them, lyrical analysis, listening to a song, tell me what part stands out to you most, talk to me about what resonates with you most. And I can't begin to tell you how many times that turns into mantras for people. And that turns into ways that they have dealt with intrusive thoughts and whatnot. And so, Tyson, Dr. Edgar Tyson was a social worker, and he felt it was important to introduce the culture into a mental health setting because traditional frameworks were not honoring the inherent therapeutic value of hip hop and of culture in general, right? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah,
because when a lot of people, when they think about hip hop, it's just the musical genre that comes to mind, but there's really much more to the culture of hip hop that resonates with people, in our communities and in our, maybe the demographics that we work with, that you really, it's difficult often to find kind of like an entryway or something. Even, it's not the same thing, but I know like there's a lot of people that give the example of when they're driving somewhere with their youth or they're taking them to an appointment or something and they let them control the radio. And, so the kids are happy about that and they're putting on their music or whatever. But that just in that short car drive can become a tool through the music, through the hip hop, through whatever they're listening to, to begin to engage, to begin to, find those entryways into the different issues that are going on. So, and a question that I had about it is, obviously I know you mentioned that you were a rapper and a DJ or an MC, and you kind of had that background. Do you think that people that don't necessarily have that background can be effective using hip hop therapy or trying to get into how to use it? Or do you have to really have that knowledge or a background, do you think?
So I used to say that you had to be a part of the culture, right, to do it. But it wasn't until I was working with an individual and I was implementing this and their friend had another therapist, and that friend was like, I want to do the same thing that therapist is doing with you. And that therapist wasn't trained in it, right? Or didn't have any awareness of it. I think that it can be utilized by clinicians. And let me go back. When I talk about hip hop therapy is used by qualified therapists, right? So that's one piece. I think that it can be used by clinicians that are not partaking in the elements of hip hop. So clinicians that are not, and I don't think that you have to be an MC or a DJ or a breakdancer or a graph artist to do this work. But I do think, because there are people that are just hip hop heads and fans of the culture, right? But I do think that you need to have a foundational, knowledge of the culture.
Yeah.
I would probably be bothered if a therapist was integrating hip hop therapy and didn't know the history of what hip hop came out of. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I would probably feel a little bit frustrated if a therapist was integrating or trying to integrate hip hop therapy, but not know the elements of hip hop or the principles of hip hop. Mm-hmm. Just like, you know, with any culture that we work with, there are principles, there are ethics, there are values, and hip hop is no different. So I think that one of the things that me, along with the other hip hop therapy clinicians that I work with, which is everyone's in different states, right, in different cities, is I think that we're probably going to have to work towards creating some sort of training as therapists that are doing this work and pushing the work, and also therapists that are educated in hip hop history and you know, the elements and what and the therapeutic themes within each element. I think we're going to have to move in that direction. So yeah, I think that's my take on it. So it might change, but that's my take on it.
I think that would be huge to create a training on it, specifically for the reason that, you know, if someone at some point does not create like this acknowledged, respected framework that stays right. true to the ideals and principles, mm-hmm. someone will do it eventually, and it may not be a person who, you know, as you mentioned, who has a true understanding of what it's all about. And so I think to be, you know, at the forefront of that, developing that training or whatever that would look like, is crucial for you and those that have really been doing it as it is intended to be done. Mm-hmm. I think that'll be crucial. So I look forward to seeing that for sure.
Yeah. And I think another piece of it too is like, if you're interested in hip hop therapy, like study the person who pioneered it, right? Like I studied Tyson's work. When I went into grad school, I went in with the intention to merge hip hop and mental health, because I knew that hip hop saved me and my friends from mm-hmm. a lot of things. So I knew that there was therapeutic things that were happening. We were talking about breakups and in writing sessions. We were talking about not feeling accepted. We're talking about things that you talk about in therapy. Mm-hmm. And so when I went into grad school, I went in with that intention, and I found Tyson's work and I studied his work and I connected with his mentee, you know, JC Hall. And so really studying the people that are doing the work, mm-hmm. I mean, and have done the work, right? From Don Elegant to Tyson to Dr. Raphael Travis, like there are people that have research. And I think that's the other thing that we need in the field too, is we, you know, hip hop heads don't need research to know that, you know, hip hop is inherently therapeutic, but we also need it in research to get it funded and to get it respected mm-hmm. by county, by insurance panels and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. It's very similar, at least in some ways. It makes me think about, you know, some other friends and colleagues of mine that practice a lot using a lot of like traditional indigenous teachings right. and healings and mm-hmm. and they actually have, I don't know if they've made it into a training yet, but more and more I think they're moving in that direction as well, because they saw kind of like, you know, people I think with good intentions and people trying to do good work, but it was more like from a new age kind of vibe. And
everyone's a holistic therapist nowadays. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. And so they've done a lot of work to really tighten up and structure an actual framework that comes from the, you know, individuals with the true knowledge of what these teachings are and, you know, so I think that as you're talking more and more, I'm seeing those parallels. And it, again, it speaks to that kind of core social work principle of meeting the client where the client is and not trying to make them, you know, work within this framework that has nothing to do with them. But if you can connect through their culture, whether it's kind of like their ethnic culture or their culture or subculture that they
culture. Yeah.
Yeah, then, you know, you're gonna, because at the end of the day, you want to just have effective outcomes and the way to get there can look so different. So I think that's, it's interesting to just think about, as I think the field, the profession opens up its eyes and opens up its minds about what else, even this whole Zoom thing and online stuff, like I feel like we've opened ourselves a little bit to different possibilities of how we can help people and not so rigid in those traditional modalities or frameworks.
Right, for sure. And the end of the day, like, you know, I think it comes down to clinicians being open to being learners and not knowers. You know, I think the greatest honor and privilege about being a therapist is getting to know people, getting to understand and know people's pain, not, you know, not sympathize with it, but really know it. And you can't do that if you don't meet the person where they're at. You can't do that if you don't tap into what is already important to them.
Yeah. So, I think I'm encouraged by the, you know, in recent years, that whole concept of cultural competency has kind of, you know, people are more now open or kind of transitioning to the concept of cultural humility, where, you know, the difference being cultural competency is you're going to learn X, Y, and Z about a culture, and that's it. You know it. You can you can use that with everybody. And cultural humility, to your point, is more about, you know, being open to listening, to learning, because every experience is different, and you have to be, back to even that point about your daughter, you have to be humble to learn from people and not think that you have an MSW or an LCSW after your name, and you're the expert.
Yeah, and I think that it goes back to the question you first asked me is like, who's qualified to do this work? And I think that, you know, that's the thing is culture constantly evolves. You can't give somebody a hip hop therapy curriculum because our hip hop is not the same as today's hip hop, right? Today's hip hop is not the same as, you know, hip hop 10 years from now. And I think like that's, even though that's the thing, even though I'm a hip hop head and man, I bump the greats, the greats to them are someone else. So I have to be open to like learning from them, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that's what's going to make hip hop therapy has a training, has, you know, has whatever that is, whatever it turns into, a little bit more complex is because culture is constantly changing, culture's constantly evolving. So you can't plug something in, right? Because
it's very dynamic.
Dynamic.
It's fluid. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I know I'm trying to watch the clock here because I know you have another thing to get to. But I did want to get to this question, and it kind of goes back a little bit to the entrepreneurship side of things. And so so you were in a position or you had the courage to kind of jump in, as you said, and have that almost like blind faith in yourself that you were going to get this done no matter what. And so do you have, there's a lot of people, it seems like myself included, but I see a lot of people that maybe don't have that courage or just aren't in a position to leave the security or whatever of a full-time job, but they have a little entrepreneurial spirit to them and they want to get out there. So what, do you have any thoughts on how someone might, instead of jumping in, maybe transition to a hustle or just a something that's more in the spirit of what they want to do with their career. Someone that wants to, transition as opposed to jump in.
Totally. I will say this. A lot of it is internal. A lot of it is mindset, right? So I think the first thing that we as social workers have to understand is that graduate schools do not prepare us to go into business for ourselves. They prepare us to go into business for other people. So that's the first thing that we really have to understand. And I think the second thing also is, you know, the spirit of entrepreneurship is essentially getting comfortable with practicing vulnerability. And vulnerability, you know, you look at Brené Brown's work, it's uncertainty, risk, emotional exposure. That is the essence of entrepreneurship, whether it's a side hustle or whether it is, the leap, you know, where you're completely leaving it all behind and opening up something. And so I think that that's the first piece is like, how comfortable are you taking risks? Whether that is reaching out to someone and asking them to mentor you, whether it is applying for a per diem job, right? Or connecting with other entrepreneurs. That's the first step is how comfortable are you at taking risks and sitting with uncertainty? And I think the third piece, right, is redefining success. That's the internal experience that you have to work at. Redefining success. Success is not necessarily applying for a side hustle and getting the job. Success for me, this is how I've defined it, is engagement. It's showing up. When the opportunity presents itself, show up. If it happens, dope. If it doesn't, you showed up. It's not caving to the fear. And I think that that's really important. And then I also think that, you know, for a person that wants to just kind of transition slowly, I would encourage you to ask yourself, like, are you growing at your full-time job? Are you being challenged? Do you like the therapist that you're becoming clinically? Are you developing leadership skills, right? All that stuff. And if you're not, and you can't afford to leave because of healthcare insurance and stable income and having kids and all that stuff, I think it's important to tap into whatever brings you purpose, whatever your heart work is. For me, I started off just reading books and research. And I tapped into that. That's what brought me joy into the field. And then the second step is I reached out to those people that were doing the research. And now, you know, now they're my good friends, but I reached out to JC Hall, who was Tyson's mentee. And I started to talk to him about maybe clinical consultation, like, hey, I'm trying to get this trauma narrative and I feel like I'm stuck here. And like, can you help me? So reaching out and building connections. And then eventually, you know, when you practice vulnerability, it's like a snowball effect. The universe kind of presents these opportunities to you. And that's where, again, are you going to show up? Are you going to engage? So it could start small, has like tap into reading a book or research paper, you know, watching YouTube videos on entrepreneurship mindset. Or it could be full on reaching out to somebody and asking them for advice or help or just dialogue and building. And I think that, and then that turns into opportunities, right? And yeah. So I think that's the biggest piece is in the engagement. You got to redefine success.
Mm-hmm. That is huge. Just how you describe redefining success is very key to this, I think, because I think through training, through education, through how we're brought in as social workers, it's very clearly, you know, defined as success is defined through those kind of traditional lenses or parameters. And so you have to be open to that. And I think just in terms of entrepreneurship, my thought is that it's such an individual thing. You know, everyone's situation is different, like you said, with healthcare or their family situation or whatever it may be. But I think, like you said, at least give yourself if you have any interest whatsoever in whatever level of entrepreneurship, at least give yourself the opportunity to be prepared and prepare yourself, reading, watching YouTube, whatever it is, like give yourself that opportunity. And you never know when, you know, something comes up or the opportunity to do a different role or something comes up that you can begin that transition. But if you just stay in that mindset of, I can't do it, I'm stuck here or whatever, then you know, you'll never really get to doing that kind of stuff that you maybe are destined to do at the end of the day anyway. So, so thank you for that perspective. That's
a fact, man. Like, I know for me, I was scared to leave my job. You know, like I was scared. I was comfortable, but I wasn't growing. And I made a commitment to myself that I was no longer willing to not grow in this work. If you don't grow in this work, especially social work, if you stop growing and you get complacent and comfortable, that literally can harm people.
Mm-hmm. It's life and death.
It's life and death. So you can't get comfortable in this work. And so, but I also want to say entrepreneurship, look, it's so different now, right? I mean, this is entrepreneurship, podcasts and creating content. Like, I think the blessing about putting myself out there in social media, even doing stuff like this, right? Like this is still an act of vulnerability for me. I get nervous all the time, right?
Tell me about it. Yes.
Yeah. But the blessing that comes from it is when people inbox me and are like, hey, you're the first social worker that I see myself in.
Well, we have a comment right here that just came in from My Social Work Inc., I think. Thank you. These are the questions that help me see beyond my pay. I'm working now on opening my brand of assisted livings. Your ideas reached me. So, yeah. I mean, exactly what you're saying, the proof is in the pudding. And I know your time is short. So I think this is a good way. I wish we had more time, and maybe in the future we'll have another opportunity.
Back on again. I would love to chop it up with you. I'm sorry I'm pressed for time today, but I'm so down to be on this again.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, and I'm glad this came in, because I think it really wraps up what you're doing. You know, what a lot of us, either on social work, TikTok or Instagram or whatever, like, yeah, we have entrepreneurial aspirations or whatever, but we're also just trying to put out content to help people and wherever it reaches people. And clearly you've done that here today with your words on this interview. So thank you, Brittany, for this. Yeah, I look forward to hopefully future conversations, and I know we'll be back and forth on online and stuff. So everybody, please follow. The description is somewhere here, at Brittany Williams LCSW on TikTok and Instagram. You can follow Social Work Mentor on all the different places. Mm-hmm. And please comment on this video or leave questions, and we'll do our best to get back to you. So thank you again, Brittany, for agreeing to do this. I really appreciate it, and I've learned a lot today, and I look forward to what's to come.
Yeah, awesome. I appreciate you.
Yeah, thanks. So we will see everybody on the next one. Make sure you like and follow and all that stuff so you get notified when the next one happens, because we're getting into the journeys of social workers and learning from each other. So thanks, everyone, and we will see you next time. So that is it for this episode of Case Notes from the Field. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. I really enjoyed the part where Brittany talked about kind of just being courageous and fearless. If there's something that you want to pursue, whether it's a full-time change and you just want to change the direction of your career, or if it's something on the side that you want to do to supplement your career, or if it's something you're just interested in that you kind of want to dip your toe in the water and see if it's a direction you might want to go into. In any of those cases, I really like the comments that Brittany had about how to just get going with entrepreneurship. And of course, the stuff that I learned about hip-hop therapy, its history, and how to apply it in your practice was super interesting to me. So I hope you got value from that just as much as I did. As I mentioned in other parts of this podcast, if you can like, follow, subscribe, or whatever is appropriate on your platform, that would help me to get the word out from this podcast and get our colleagues and other social workers and practitioners to hear from our interviews and hear from our guests. I would really appreciate if you could do that. So that's enough for now. Make sure you do those things, because in that way you'll be notified when the next one comes out, and I got some good ones on deck. So thanks for listening, and I will see you, or talk to you at least, soon. Bye-bye.